From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 60 years ago today, Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. It authorized the U.S. Army to establish sensitive, quote, military areas within the United States and remove any and all persons thought threatening to the American war effort. In all, more than 120,000 people, mostly American citizens living on the West Coast, were sent to isolated internment camps. In this hour, a look back at an officially regretted moment in American history and its lessons for today. We begin the hour with the personal story of California Congressman Robert Matsui. As an infant, he was taken with his family to an internment camp in California. As a member of Congress, he spearheaded legislation to compensate and apologize to the internees. Earlier, I asked the congressman to describe his family's ordeal.
My parents, who were both in their early 20s, and I was 6 months old when this happened, when they were given the executive order under Executive Order 9066 to, within 72 hours, just take what they could take and report at the Memorial Auditorium, and then there were shipped out to Tule Lake. They had to basically sell their home. It was quit claimed by them to somebody for $50. My dad had just purchased a new car, and he gave it away, essentially, and my dad and his brother had a small business in Sacramento County. It was a wholesale produce business, and they just abandoned that. Before they knew it, within 3 days, they were being shipped to Tule Lake. And it's interesting because my mother and father really would not talk about this until the year was in the mid-'80s or early 80s. And my mother, she was dying at the time, and she began to talk about it. And my dad didn't talk about it until near his death as well. It was a subject that they really couldn't talk about because the mere raising of the fact that they were incarcerated by their own government raises the specter of disloyalty. And so it was just very difficult for them to talk about. I couldn't talk about this subject until just 15 years ago. I recall when I was in the fourth grade at William Land School in Sacramento County, one of my very well-intentioned teachers, who was talking about the World War II period and obviously in a history-type class, said, "Bob, weren't you in one of the prison camps for Japanese during World War II?" And I just looked at my classmates, and I remember just feeling very, very uncomfortable and saying, "I don't know what you're talking about." Later, when we were in the playground, a couple of my very close fourth-grade friends said, "Well, were you in jail? Were you a spy?" And so the mere raising of this issue by the Japanese-American community raised the specter that, well, maybe something they did was wrong. Maybe they were disloyal to their country. And so it was a subject that really couldn't be brought up. In 1981, when a commission was set up to investigate the internment and, you know, whether it was an absence of leadership or what happened and how it happened, and then, you know, the possibility of compensation, monetary compensation, that's when people began to talk about it. And when the commission came up with recommendations in 1983 and basically said it was an absence of leadership and there was no case of disloyalty or espionage or anything by any American of Japanese ancestry or any resident.
I was struck in just reading up about this, the role that that Owen Roberts, the Supreme Court Justice, played in it. He came out with his report on Pearl Harbor in late January of 42 and alleged there that the Japanese attack on Pearl had been abetted by Japanese Americans or nationals on Hawaii without proof.
Yeah. One of the reasons I think that we did not see the kind of discrimination and fur that we saw with Japanese Americans, with the Arab American community, is because the political leadership in this country since September 11th has been very supportive of the Arab American community. When the president went to the mosque some days after the September 11th tragedy and spoke up about good Arab American citizens, I think that helped quell any possibility of outward racism. And with respect to the Japanese American community, as we all know, you know, not only did people like John McCloy and others fan the flames of hatred, but also even Justice Earl Warren, who was then running for governor of the state of California, was very adamant about the Japanese-American communities. I view what happened during that period is a latent sentiment that existed throughout the 1890s and 1900s up until 1941 is kind of an anti-Asian sentiment in the state of California. Pearl Harbor basically triggered that sentiment and brought it to the forefront. We don't see that today. I think there was a lesson that we all learned from 1941-42, and you know, because of that, I think our country is better, stronger, and has a greater sensitivity to diversity.
It's heartening to think we can learn from history, especially from a shameful episode like this. At your camp, Tule Lake, that was the place where the No-No Boys went. Who were they?
Well, they were basically those who were American citizens and who took the position that they did not have to reaffirm their loyalty to the United States.
You could get out of the camp if you took a loyalty oath and if you said you would serve in the service. Is that right?
Yes, that occurred later, but that's exactly right. And when they refused to take the loyalty oath, many of them were actually shipped to Japan.
And they did so on reasons of pride, I assume.
On pride and on the basis that they didn't have to defend their citizenship to this country, that they were, and unless there was some reason to dispute it, they didn't need to defend it. They were a small minority in the Japanese-American community at that time.
Sure.
Most of them were reluctant to stand out and take strong positions.
And understandably, although your colleague in the Senate, Dan Inouye, lost an arm fighting for America in Italy, didn't he?
He did. And it's ironic, but to a large extent, the 442nd Combat Troop, Americans of Japanese ancestry who fought on the European front, were instrumental in helping people like myself not have to reprove my loyalty by fighting as they did.
And we want to remember Sadao Minamori, who won the Medal of Honor. He was at Manzanar camp, and he threw himself on a grenade in Italy to protect his men.
It's interesting because I've talked to many of the Nisei who fought in that 442nd Combat Troop, and many of them have said that they needed to do this in order to demonstrate to the world of their loyalty to their country. They had the highest casualty rate in the history of the United States Army, and they also had the greatest number of medals that were given to any combat troop.
What a story.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. And President Clinton, he actually had the records reexamined. And they did come up with an additional 29 Medal of Honor recipients, including Dan Inouye.
Yeah, he was given a Medal of Honor just in our time.
So, in a way, the 1987 redress legislation that became law, signed by President Reagan, and provided token compensation to each survivor of the internment camps, along with the Medal of Honor recipients, and then along with a memorial to the Japanese Americans that were both interned and who fought in the 442nd, now is in the nation's capital. All three of those have gone a long ways in kind of healing the wounds and is a historical monument for the country to look back on. And, you know, and it's a lesson. In a time of great stress, we need to be more mindful of people's differences and the fact that we need to make sure that we protect all people under our Constitution.
Robert Matsui is a congressman from California. He spoke to us from Sacramento. We're talking this hour about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Today marks the 60th anniversary of the day FDR signed the executive order that sent thousands of Americans to internment camps. How does this day of infamy resonate with you today? Do you remember those times? Do you see similarities to today's treatment of Arab Americans or Arab nationals in the U.S. after September 11th? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me from North Carolina is Eric Muller, a law professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law and author of the new book, Free to Die for Their Country, the story of Japanese-American draft resistors in World War II. With me in the studio is tonight's guest news analyst, Juliet Kayyem, head of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and formerly a lawyer with the U.S. Justice Department. Welcome to you both.
Good evening. Good evening.
Eric Mueller, just to set the table here, the question of anachronism is always an important question in history. To what extent, when we look back on that decision, are we being anachronistic? That is to say, are we applying moral standards and an outlook that we have today to a time when practically no one shared it? What's your feeling about that?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I can certainly remember, you know, sitting around even with my own grandparents and talking about the World War II, expressing outrage at some of the things that happened and having them sit there and say, you know what, Eric, you just don't know what you're talking about. You don't understand what the situation in the country was like. You don't understand the pressures the nation was under. And always, when I was writing my book, Free to Die for Their Country, I had to contend with that problem of trying not to write a book with year 2002 values looking back on something that happened in 1942. So there is the risk, I think, of anachronism. But there were good people who stood up even in that time, and both within and outside the Japanese-American community, and had the courage to label what the government was doing as deeply wrong and morally outrageous. So it certainly took courage back then, but there were those who did have the courage to stand up and say so. I write about some of those men, actually, in my book.
Good. Can you just mention a couple of them?
Well, the book that I've written is about a sort of subset of the internees in the camps. These were young men who were drafted into the U.S. Army from inside the camps. Early 1944, the government announced that it was going to begin drafting people out of the camps and into the U.S. Army. And most of the young men grudgingly complied, just as virtually all Japanese Americans had done when they were ordered into the camps in the first place. But several hundred young men at the 10 camps resisted the draft. They simply took the position that if they were loyal enough to be in the army, they should not be behind barbed wire. And they stood up for their rights. They tried to use draft resistance as a method of challenging the lawfulness of the entire program of internment and incarceration. This is not a story we hear a lot about because, mm-hmm. tragically, for some of the reasons that Congressman Matsui may have just been alluding to, these young men came to be seen as the real black sheep of the Japanese-American family, seen in a sense as proving the government's case of disloyalty that was being leveled against all Japanese-Americans, when in fact, in my research, which included lots of interviews with the surviving resistors themselves, it's very clear to me that this was a deeply patriotic resistance movement. This was the patriotism of protest, which is a very American tradition, in a sense more American than it is Japanese. So there were people inside the camps who spoke up. Outside the camps, the ACLU struggled a bit with what to do on the Japanese-American cases, but eventually they came around. Especially the California chapter of the ACLU came around and provided support. So too did the Quakers. The Society of Friends were very, very supportive of Japanese Americans throughout the entire ordeal and afterwards. So there were some both within the community and some outside it who did have the, I don't know, perspective to see that what was happening was a drastic, grievous overreaction.
Yeah, and just reading about this today in David Kennedy's book, Freedom from Fear, I was struck with the role the press played in whipping up some of this hysteria from the sort of, you know, from Westbrook Pegler at the Hearst end to Walter Lippmann at the in Olympus. The press was just insinuating, well, you know, you've got to, you can't be sure of these people, and after all, California could be a battlefield. Was that typical of what we were getting in that early 1942?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There was a period of a couple of weeks after Pearl Harbor when Japanese America was just holding its breath. The FBI swept through Japanese communities within 2 or 3 days of Pearl Harbor and pretty much emptied it of its entire alien leadership. But Japanese American citizens, the Nisei as they were called, sat and waited and wondered what was going to happen. But within several weeks, the press and also agricultural interests out in California.
Hold that thought, Eric Mueller. Thanks. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the Japanese internment 60 years ago today. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the Japanese internment. 60 years ago today it began. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like your comment, recollection, judgment. Eric Muller, our law professor at the University of North Carolina and the author of a new book, Free to Die for Their Country, the story of the Japanese-American draft resistors in World War II. Before the break, you were just telling us about the roundup of the Japanese.
Right. The
Japanese-Americans.
The first roundup was of the leaders of the alien Japanese community, the Issei, as that generation mm-hmm. were called. Between 1,200 and 1,500 arrested virtually overnight after Pearl Harbor. Then there was a period of a few weeks when everyone was sort of living in fear, wondering what was going to happen. The Attorney General made a few quiet noises about the need to protect the civil liberties of everyone. But then he was just swallowed up in an avalanche of frenzy, really, coming primarily from agricultural economic interests in California, who viewed Japanese farmers as the enemy, as very, very successful competitors. They'd been trying to eliminate them for decades. And also, as you mentioned before, the press, even the liberal press, even Walter Lippmann, came out very powerfully with the argument that there was no way to tell a loyal from a disloyal Japanese person, and therefore they should all be rounded up and shipped away. These political pressures ended up prevailing in the debate. And by February 19th, 60 years ago, Franklin Roosevelt had the order on his desk that set the whole thing into motion.
Mm. Judith Kayyem.
Well, I think Eric makes a great point, and we also heard from the congressman about, I think, the political, moral, and ethical lessons coming out of the executive order and the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans. I guess I want to add one more to this, which may just be the practical lessons. From what I know, not a single spy was in this group. We learned very little about Japan's intentions during World War II. This was, from a law enforcement perspective, a bust. The amount of time, effort, and everything else that went into interring this many people really proved, from a law enforcement perspective, not very helpful. And I think that those are lessons we can learn today as we're sort of in the midst of this very difficult debate about terrorism and about the fact that we have a threat here in America. It is from Islamic extremism, from certain areas of the world that are visually identifiable, and this debate about profiling, whether it's at airports or wherever else, it doesn't make for good law enforcement to swoop in men, women, and children, as we did during the Japanese internment, that in fact, from a very practical, there are very practical lessons to learn from this as well.
Hmm. We're also joined in the studio by Paul Watanabe. He's a professor of political science and co-director of the Institute for Asian American Studies at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Welcome, Paul.
Good evening.
Paul, you were born after the internment, but your family was interned in a camp. Where was that, and what did they tell you about that experience?
Well, my mother was actually born in the United States by actually some accident. Nobody else in her family was an American citizen, but she happened to be in Idaho when she was born. So she was an American citizen by birth, but raised and schooled in Japan. My father was an immigrant and never became an American citizen. And actually, I realized, sort of looking at some documents from the internment experience, that he clearly probably came in the United States in an undocumented fashion. As most people know, after 1924, immigration from Asia generally was pretty much barred. And clearly, he came into the United States sometime after 1924. And my brother was born on December 2nd, 1941, 5 days before Pearl Harbor. So in some ways, they had a very interesting situation. And as Professor Muller pointed out, my father was sort of in this precarious position, not an American citizen. And therefore, he was initially taken to a different camp, to Tule Lake. And my mother and the young young, now American citizen, just a couple months old, were taken to a different camp, to Manzanar. Mm-hmm. As part of sort of the long story of the situation, my mother, it was also mentioned by Congressman Matsui that there was a loyalty oath which was administered. My mother was subjected to the loyalty oath and answered no to the questions. And it was an interesting consequence of that, is that now by answering no to those questions, she was then, along with her infant son, moved to Tule Lake and reunited with my father. She subsequently also lost her American citizenship because of having responded in that fashion.
Why did she say no to the...
Well, it's an interesting question. On the one hand, I believe, and she's told me this, and as pointed out by Congressman Matsui, this is something that was not talked about a lot. But she indicated to me that she was just very angry about what the United States government had done to her and her family and her young child. So there was clearly that. In other words, there's not this view, I think a lot of people have, that a lot of these people who were taken away were surprised or didn't know what was going on. Many of these people understood what was happening to their civil liberties and their rights and their freedoms. And they were angry about it. And as Professor Mueller pointed out, some people, rightly, in my opinion, acted on their anger by not, for example, submitting themselves to the draft. In her case, she did that. But also, she may have done something very practical by doing this, which is this became a mechanism by which she ultimately was reunited. The family was reunited at Tule Lake. And I did find that at the time of the end of the war, they were actually preparing for repatriation back to Japan.
Mm. We actually have on the line Ellie, who was in California at the time. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You can hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and most of the people who I knew in L.A. living there at that time were fully aware of the prejudice against Japanese in California. It already has been made very, very clear that there were farming interests that wanted to get rid of the Japanese farmers. Actually, there were small one-acre farms in Los Angeles County, which I recall. And these were the most efficient, effective producers in California. They were highly competitive, and they wanted to get rid of them. And this was the main economic motive. But my real question is, why is it that the Japanese in Hawaii were treated so differently from the Japanese in the West Coast, and especially in California? In other words, what made it all...
Jack, why were we in danger from the Japanese in California, but not in Hawaii? Never discussed.
Yeah, Eric Mueller, how about that?
Well, you know, the caller puts his finger on one of the many, many paradoxes that run through the government's conduct in this entire period. It certainly does seem positively perverse that the Japanese, the ethnically Japanese community in the place that was most militarily sensitive, Hawaii, was not interned when those on the west coast of the United States were. And there is a deep paradox there. There were some Hawaiian Japanese Americans who were, in fact, moved out of their homes into camps in Hawaii, not camps of the size or scope that we know in the mainland United States, much smaller place. The other thing to remember about Hawaii, though, there's actually two other things. One of them is that Japanese Americans in Hawaii were an extraordinarily important part of the labor force. Mm-hmm. And so it would have been extremely difficult for Hawaii to get by if all of its Japanese and Japanese American population were placed under armed guard. The other thing to remember, too, though, is that Hawaii from December 8th of 1941 on for several years was under martial law. So it is not exactly the case to say that anyone in Hawaii was completely free in the way that a person would be free on the mainland. There was, in fact, military law in Hawaii at that time.
Mm-hmm. But in some ways, what you suggest is, in fact, indicates it wasn't so much of a paradox. That is to say that in Hawaii, the Japanese were needed. They were essential to the economic situation. Ironically, they were essential to the military effort as well. They served various elements of the United States Army there. And their numbers were large.
Exactly. Exactly.
Here on the mainland, it's interesting because in some ways they were perceived not as economically essential, but of course, as has been pointed out for a long period of time, economic competitors. And that was in some ways the context to understand, I think, the actions that were taking place, that in some ways the internment was kind of a middle position in a long history, I think, of treating Asian Americans generally prior to the Japanese in a particular way. And frankly, I don't think simply ended with the freeing them from the camps, in some cases, in my family's case, until 1946. That the story doesn't end there, and it continues, I think, right up to the current period of time with different groups involved. That's a little bit of answer, I guess, to Jack's question to Professor Muller earlier. I don't see it as a sort of an aberration. I do think there is, in some respects, a continuum.
Spell that out for us, Paul. What's the continuum?
Well, in some ways, the whole issue after September 11th about the internment was clearly on people's minds. Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation, reports, who was interned, I believe, at Heart Mountain, is that the case?
Yeah.
That he talks about the first full cabinet meeting on September 12th that took place in the White House, where there were congressional leaders also invited. And I think it was David Obey mentioned, he said, that he was a little worried about what this might mean for people of Arab and Muslim descent within the United States. And George Bush is said to have interrupted at that point and said, well, you're absolutely right, David. We don't want happening to those people what happened to Norm's family, to Norm and Norm's family. So clearly it was on the president's mind at the time. We can talk about what he did with that information, and I don't think that he really learned all of, I think, the right lessons of that experience, but also was on the minds of the American public. It's interesting, there was a lot of polling that was done after September 11th, and Gallup reports that there was polling done, and one of the questions specifically, interestingly, asked was, would you favor the creation of internment camps as was done in the other day of infamy after December 7th, 1941? And it's interesting, when you read Gallup's summary, they said that fortunately, only 34% of the people polled would support that. And so they perceived the fact that one out of three people, only one out of three people in their view, supported the idea of having internment camps as in some kind of a wonderful finding. Mm. So it was on a lot of people's minds, I think, that experience.
Yeah. And I want to pick up on Paul's point that, you know, the fact that the internment camps had existed sort of is so outrageous as we look at it from hindsight that almost anything that sort of isn't that seems acceptable. And I think it sort of kept us from some major issues that are going on right now that are not clearly internment, but are having an incredibly detrimental impact on certain communities. So you have the detention issue, you have the immigration issue impacting Arab and Muslim communities. So while I think the public statements of the president have been overwhelmingly positive and I think have gone a long way to stop some of the bad things that could have happened in wake of September 11th, in particular hate crimes, vigilantism, there are some activities that are being done that of course are not even close to the internment of Japanese Americans, but certainly deserve some discussion. It can't be, you know, these polar extremes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there's another example of this continuity, and that is the legacy of the Korematsu decision, which essentially constitutionalized this conflict. Confiscation of property and this removal of people. And Justice Jackson wrote about it. He said it lies about like that decision does, which allows the government to do this sort of thing. It lies about like a loaded weapon ready for the hand of any authority that can bring forward a plausible claim to an urgent need.
Yeah, my fear is that in some ways John Ashcroft has picked up that loaded weapon, and I think a lot of other people have gone along with him. I mean, Ashcroft did not do this alone. Bush did not do this alone. The United States Congress went along with it. You all know the fervor that was raised when one dissenting voice was raised very early on about the idea of giving full powers to the President of the United States to pursue military action in this war. So there has been this great call for unity, which occurs, of course, in these kinds of struggles, this great patriotic fervor. But I think one thing that a lesson of these kinds of crises is that while there's calls for unity, there is a division at home between us and them, that it's not all of us together. Mm-hmm. What the unity suggests is that there are certain people who, to use the president's language, who are with us or against us. That occurs in the international arena, assuredly, but I think these times of crisis indicate that they occur in the domestic arena as well.
Yep.
And it is usually immigrant groups or groups, non-white groups, that are in some ways the ones who are waiting around, who are vulnerable to be placed in the category of them.
Yeah, and we don't want to pat ourselves too hardly, too much on the back, because I think about 8 or 10 people were murdered.
That's right.
Arabs or Arab Americans,
in fact, Sikhs, who don't even qualify in the.
So it wasn't. We didn't have official persecution, perhaps, but we certainly had a lot of vigilante activity. Let's take a call from Robert. Hello.
Hello. My name is Robert Paracci, and I'm an Italian American descendant.
Okay.
I'd like to broaden this discussion out a bit.
Please.
War, I agree with. I agree 100% with your speaker on the Japanese American issue. You know, what happened to them was inhumane. But as a descendant of Italian and Germans, I know I feel much guilt for what they did along with the Japanese as an Axis power. That was Mussolini's term, for that matter. But let's look at this in a culturally sensitive way. The Americans and Europeans traditionally made it extremely clear that war was declared before attack. You know, in the case of the Japanese, it was, you know, an undeclared attack. It was, quote, a sneak attack. And that was, you know, not in guide with the culture of, you know, the European Americans. And I have to also keep in mind that the three Axis powers, Japan, Italy, and Germany, wanted to conquer the world. You know, as a descendant of these Axis powers, I had to look at the American reaction in a broader context of, you know, saving democracy and freedom.
Right, right. Let's let Eric Mueller comment on that. Eric?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is in some senses a difficult problem, but I think in some ways it's actually it might be a bit easier than the caller makes it sound. For whatever connection the caller may feel to the actions of his Italian ancestors, the problem in 1941 and 1942 was that the law was presuming something about one's loyalties and suspicions based simply on the fact of one's ethnicity. It's important to remember that of the 120,000 people who were placed in camps, something like 65% of them were American citizens born in this country, just like, you know, just like Fiorello LaGuardia, who was the mayor of New York at that time. There was no discussion, seriously, about taking Italian Americans or German Americans, you know, taking Joe DiMaggio and putting him in a concentration camp. Because in the case of white people, it was very difficult for people to believe that somebody would carry with them onto these shores the views of their ancestors. But when the person looks like the enemy, all of a sudden it's a different story. And so I think that that's not to take away from the caller's point that it's important to reflect on the actions of one's forebears. But as a matter of law, Japanese American citizens of Japanese ancestry stood completely guiltless and had exactly the same, were deserving of the same presumption of loyalty that every other American citizen had, yet they selectively did not receive it.
Thanks, Eric Mueller. Eric Mueller is the author of the new book, Free to Die for Their Country, the story of the Japanese American draft resistors in World War II. We're talking about the internment of the Japanese in 60 years ago. Today it began. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the internment of the Japanese American citizens of the on the West Coast in 1942. And you can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guests are Paul Watanabe. He's a professor of political science and co-director of the Institute for Asian American Studies at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. And he's in the studio, and with him is Juliet Kayyem. She's our guest news analyst tonight. She's head of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Let's take a call from Imran. Hello.
Hi. You know, I just wanted to say that, you know, how does this resonate today? And I was at as a Pakistani-American who was born in this country and is a Muslim, I have to admit that after September 11th, you know, I really felt for the first time in my life that I was categorized as the other.
The other.
And, you know, 30 years of my life growing up in this country were almost like irrelevant because of being grouped.
Were there particular experiences that did this, or is this just the general feeling?
It's the general feeling, and you know, I know a lot of people in the Pakistani-American and the Pakistani community in general that have talked about actually going back to Pakistan because they feel that, you know, the level of you know, enmity towards, you know, Muslims in general has risen substantially because of September 11th. The other thing I wanted to mention was the role of the press, I think you had addressed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I find is that there are certain, you know, columnists who really almost like engage in a level of vitriol against Muslims in general. And what you end up feeling is very defensive about being a Muslim.
Mm.
And it's in the Wall Street Journal, it's in the Boston Globe, it's in the New York Times.
Who can you name names for us?
Well, sure. You know, it's like, for example, you know, Jeff Jacoby, I think when
Boston Globe
two members of the JDL had bombed, you know, or were discovered for having bomb-making materials, you know, he put out an article in the Globe saying that, you know, where's the Muslim voice, you know, condemning this, and why are the Muslims always silent on, these types of things?
Yeah.
And Diana Eck from Harvard University actually, you know, rose to the challenge and said, you know, the American Muslims did condemn September 11th immediately after it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave a list of different Muslim organizations that had put, you know, their regrets and their sorrows, and mm-hmm. said that we don't support this and we categorically condemn it.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, I mean, Jeff Jacoby's a local person, but
sure.
I mean, it's also in the national paper.
Sure, sure. Well, you raise a good point, Imran. Thank you. Paul Watanabe, was there anything like that with the Japanese Americans after the war? They just said, we don't want to live in a country like this, and they went back home?
Sure. There was a lot of the same kind of response, and I appreciate very much the call in some ways, and that is that it's interesting. It's the technique that he pointed out that people like Jeff Jacoby and that utilize. It's really implicit in the notion of the loyalty oath, which was given in, as was mentioned, World War II. It's implicit in the notion of drafting some of these people who were in the camps themselves, remember, mm-hmm. who were then asked to serve in the military first. They were asked to volunteer, and then there was this draft which took place, which Professor Mueller pointed out. And this constitutes what I refer to as kind of this loyalty trap.
Mm.
People are placed in a position, this Pakistani-American caller, kind of where they have to defend, in some ways, where their real loyalties might reside. My mother had to answer a question about where, despite the fact she was an American citizen, about where her loyalties really were. And you had to kind of take up a gun, leave the camps, go and serve in the military in some ways to once again prove your loyalty, and that's in some ways what was done, and that's a good side of things.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, there are these issues about what right does one have to even ask this of individuals? And it's not being asked of everyone.
Mm.
Everyone on the street is not being detained in a sort of or stopped at an airplane checkpoint in an undifferentiated fashion.
Sure.
It's people that are being targeted. It's people being detained. And by the way, it's just not people with bad looks. It's in the sense that nasty looks to people or furtive glances. The issue about this that I think is of greatest concern, it was the government of the United States. You know, we're talking today about Executive Order 9066.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's remember who the executive was. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the Supreme Court supporting these decisions.
Yeah.
This is a Supreme Court that had William O. Douglas on it, for example.
Hugo Black.
These are real... Racism or these attitudes become very important, particularly when it is people like the President of the United States, where it's Franklin Roosevelt, or whether it's George Bush or it's John Ashcroft that stand behind them.
Yeah. Judah Kayyem, let's just board another train of thought. You worked in the Justice Department when the issue arose about compensation to the victims of the internment. Tell us about that. You must have heard testimony. You must have immersed yourself in this.
I mean, for the most part, when the legislation passed, sum of money was granted. The Department of Justice administered, actually through the Civil Rights Division, which I think is kind of telling, administered the reparations program, which was Japanese Americans who either had been interred or whose family members had been interred and they had been impacted by it could request reparations, sums of money. So it was a, for most cases, it was a very basic, just prove it. There was a documentation. There were, though, you know, really difficult cases. There was a series of Japanese Peruvians who had actually been interred. Very small number. Would they be granted? I think the what animated the application of that law was a real feeling that America did need to, whatever the sum of money was, make some amends for what it did. So for the most part, most people got in. But it was, you know, it was a tragic series of stories about how people were financially, emotionally. I mean, you were talking 50 years later and people, the way it impacted their life, people who were 4, 5, or 6 years old for, you know, their entire life and, of course, their families' lives. You know, and the iron...
And the compensation was token.
Yeah, I mean, I would say for the most part,
$20,000.
Yeah, it was about $20,000, and that, you know, just picking up on something we've been talking about, the sort of the internment, and then you mentioned the Korematsu case. You know, there's an irony of the internment as well. I don't mean to put it so crudely, but what came out of this debate, this very public debate about race, was, you know, about a decade later, when Korematsu set the standard that you read, that it had to be in a very compelling interest, that it was Brown versus the Board of Education 10 years later, which came out, which would sort of a lot of people view as maybe the opposite, or at least an attempt to be the opposite. Now, there's a lot of debates out there in the legal community about Brown versus Board of Education, but, you know, that is sort of one of the impacts of the reparation Korematsu debate.
And this brings in the internment as a metaphor, the internment, the apology, and the compensation as a metaphor for African-Americans. Randall Robinson, the activist, point in his book, The Debt, says, we did this for the Japanese. It's being done now for Jews in Europe. Why can't we have an apology for slavery and compensation?
I think it's a reasonable argument to be raised by Black Americans. And in some ways, the debt is a much greater one. It's a longer one, and it's a more substantial one than that's owed the Japanese Americans, which is not. And of course, I don't perceive that as being a small debt. I believe that it's a legitimate issue. And let's realize that it was a large struggle, even in the case of the Japanese-American internment, to get that apology, to get that redress. It's pretty clear that even when President Reagan signed that legislation, ultimately, he authorized the funds but did not appropriate them. And many people argue that it was not at all just a chance that it took place in 1988, which was a presidential election year, and California was considered quite important in the in that particular election.
So even there, it was a very controversial thing. Paul Watanabe, thank you very much. Paul Watanabe is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. And Judith Kayyem, thank you. She's the head of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School. You can read the first chapter of Eric Muller's Free to Die for Their Country by going to our website. The address is onpointradio.org. Estelle Breed spent most of her life working for the San Diego Public Library. When President Roosevelt signed the executive order leading to the internment of Japanese Americans, many of the people she knew were sent off to the camps. During the war, she exchanged more than 250 letters with internees. Here are a few of those letters as read by members of our staff.
August 3rd, 1942. Dear Miss Breed, as I've told you before, rumors fly thick and fast. Most of us are expecting to be relocated soon. We've heard that we will be moved to Idaho, Colorado, Wyoming, and Arkansas. Wherever we go, we all realize it will be rough going because other people have refused to live there before us. We also know the weather will be nothing like beautiful California weather. It will probably be very hot or extremely cold. Officials will not confirm anything because they do not know anything, so the obvious result is rumors. Do you know on August 8th will be exactly 4 months since we came here? The days certainly fly fast, but the months just crawl by. I hope this war will be over before long. Sincerely, Fuchsia.
February 19th, 1943. Dear Miss Breed, I am sorry to report that many have begun to like this camp life, so easygoing with hardly any worries aside from what other way time can be more leisurely spent. I think that it harms the youths more than anyone else. The old folks have lived their lives. The young married folks still have their hopes. But it's the high school age group and also the early 20s that are becoming lazy and ambitionless other than to play all day. Live on the government is their creed. After all, old Uncle Sammy will take care of them, so why worry about the future? They are pretty disillusioned and cynical. However, there is hope, because now, with all the young fellows going out, many are becoming conscious of the outside. I haven't kept myself well posted on the number of people or the destination of all of them, but the meager information that has come to my attention seems to indicate that Chicago, Denver, Cleveland, Minneapolis, Cincinnati, and St. Louis are the big towns that are attracting the most. What a difference time makes. The cry was, "Go west, young man," and now it is, "Go east, young Nisei." Sincerely yours, Ted.
April 9th, 1943. Dear Miss Breed, yesterday marks my first year in camp. Time certainly flies. As I sit listening to my history teacher, Miss Wawrowski, talking about the problems of today, a tidal wave of memories came rushing before my eyes. That feeling of sorrow and the emptiness of my tummy comes back to me every time I think of how I left San Diego. I shall never forget how I spent that night of April 7th, sleeping on the train. My sister and I stuck our heads out the window, never peeling our eyes off the direction of our home. We filled our eyes with the sight of San Diego to the limit until my pupils gave in and I dozed off. When I woke this morning 1 year ago, I looked up at my ceiling and a funny, strange feeling came over me. I knew I was not at home and had a terrible yearning to go home. A little boy next door was crying, asking his mother to take him home. That day, I felt so lost. I was as blue as the deep blue sea. Today, that homesickness still is within me, but that lost feeling has disappeared. I often wonder how I have changed in thought, actions, knowledge, and facial and physical features during that short, memorable 1 year. Most sincerely, Louise Ogawa.
May 26, 1944. Dear Miss Breed, things have been popping rather fast lately. A cold spell, a rainstorm, and good news. When the Army came here to Camp 3 to register the men under selective service and also to take volunteers for the Japanese-American combat unit, it was the best piece of news we Nisei have had in a long time. We Nisei were despairing in ever becoming recognized, but now we have the chance to prove our loyalty. Because after the evacuation, Nisei were classed as aliens, ineligible for military service. I am proud to say that the San Diego group has the most volunteers than any other group in camp. Altogether in our block, we have just about 15 volunteers, including yours truly, which makes about the best record yet. This is the bunch to be with because we are all volunteers and there won't be those slackers and pro-Axis minded as there would be if the men were drafted. Yes, sirree, all of us are itching to go. So if everything goes well, I'll be writing to you from an army camp instead of a relocation center. Sincerely yours, Ted.
January 14th, 1945, Sunday evening. Dear Miss Breed, the news of being able to go back to California has been accepted with mingled feeling. First of all, we're more than glad that the ban has been lifted, as it rightfully should be. Those with property are wanting to go back, but wondering how the sentiment will be. Of course we know that good friends like you will be glad to have us back, but others who do not know us or understand us may not be as glad to see us. As for us who are not so fortunate to have property in California, we're content to stay here for a while, or maybe the rest of our life. But we'll make a point of seeing and visiting California later. Well, this will be all for now. But may I wish you a happy new year and hope you'll write when you have time. Sincerely, Fuchsia.
Letters from internees in Poston, Arizona, as read by WBUR's Karen Schiffman, Sean Cole, and Eileen Imada. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate Dimio, Graham Griffith, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Michael Kearns, and Laura Tanguso. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.